Well, good morning, everybody. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. And we are very excited for a number of reasons. It's Friday, number one, so we're excited about that. And that will usher in the weekend. And I hope you have wonderful weekend plans and we'll be able to, you know, compartmentalize and do what you need to do over the next couple of days and enjoy your time. Also, we're excited because we have a great group today, a wonderful, wonderful group on the panel. I will introduce them in just a moment. And not only that, but also this morning, we have Chuck Todd is going to be on the show. We're very excited to have NBC's Chuck Todd on the program. Chuck is going to be taking part in a New York State Writers Institute Telling the Truth in a Post-Truth World panel series, which happens tonight at 5:30 at Page Hall. And this is the sixth time the New York State Writers Institute has done this. And this one is really good. One is about the sort of resuscitation of the Democratic Party, and that's at 5:30. Paul Grondahl will host that event, in which Chuck Todd is taking part. Also, Paul Tonko is on that panel. And then at 7 o'clock, there will be one on the Republican Party, and they have a great lineup for that, including our very own John Faso. So a really good event that will take place, and you can go to the New York State Writers Institute page to find out more information. But we'll be talking to Chuck Todd around 11:45 this morning. Also, speaking of great broadcasters, Connie Chung has been an idol of mine for many, many years. She is an amazing journalist. She is a trailblazer, a groundbreaker. A lot of those cracks in the glass ceiling in broadcasting are because of her and what she has done. The first Asian woman ever to anchor a evening newscast, second woman ever to anchor a evening newscast, and just a fantastic broadcaster. Worked for every network. She worked with NBC, CBS, ABC, MSNBC, and CNN. And I'm probably missing others that she worked for as well. We have a one-hour special on Connie Chung coming up at 11 o'clock this morning. So a very special show, and we look forward to sharing it with you. All right. Now, let's get to the subjects at hand and a great group of people in front of me, and let me get my all of my introductions in order here. Public policy and communications expert Teresa Bourgeois joins us. Good morning, Teresa. How are you?
Good morning. Good morning. I'm doing well in this rainy morning rain that we desperately needed. So
yeah,
let's go. It's all good. And snow in the mountains, so that's needed too.
Yeah, and it's less rain than yesterday, but that's, you know, it's again. Yeah, we need it. That's absolutely right.
And I'm so excited for our guest today.
Me too. I'm absolutely excited. We'll get to that in just a second. Jim Henler joins us, Tetherless World Professor of Computer, Web, and Cognitive Sciences at RPI. Jim Henler is here. Good morning, Jim.
Good morning, Joe.
How are you?
Yes. I haven't figured out a better answer.
I think
to
that's
that
about
these
right. Yeah, I understand. Siena College Professor of Economics Aaron Pasitti joins us. Good morning, Aaron. How are you?
Good morning. I'm doing well. Perhaps it's just because I'm weird, or because I grew up in Cleveland. Like, I love days like yesterday that are just cold and gray and rainy. They're just so comforting to me.
There is something comforting.
Yeah.
Yeah. The rain is very cold, though. When you come in, it's like, oh. Yeah.
But maybe I think that's the thing I like, is that you come out from the rain and then you go inside and you're like, oh, here we go. Now it's
time to. Well, that's true. And you feel vaguely cleansed.
Sure. Yeah, exactly. I think we all need a mental squeegee after the past week. So.
A mental squeegee. That's good. Good line.
That's a keeper.
Now, we have been lucky enough over the last several weeks to have students that accompany Aaron with him as he joins us on Fridays. These are students from Siena College's Federal Reserve Challenge course, and we have found them to be incredibly intelligent, amazing young people who add a lot to the conversation. And we really enjoy their participation and them being here. And it's been great to get to know them. We have a new group this morning, so let me introduce them to you. We welcome Angela Everett to the program. Good morning, Angela. How are you?
I'm well. How are you?
I'm fine. Thank you very much for being here. Tell me the Angela Everett story.
So I'm over at Siena College, obviously, as a double major in finance and economics. I work a lot with the undergraduate business research over at Siena College. And I'm a senior, so I'm still going out into the job market and looking currently for my after graduation plans.
So dream world would be what?
So currently I'm hoping to end up in healthcare insurance sales, but what happens.
All right. Yes, because I know most people consider healthcare to be a dream world. That's good.
But for every seat. So.
But yeah. Congratulations. That's wonderful. Also next to Angela is Molly McBain. Molly, good morning. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, tell us Molly's story.
So I'm a junior economics major. I have three minors in business, data science, and math. And I'm unsure of what my post-graduation plans are at the moment. I'm really considering grad school. I love economics. I feel like I have a lot more to learn.
Yeah. Do you know where you'd go to grad school?
No clue.
Yeah. All right. Well, you got time.
Yeah.
You're fine. Yeah. Well, that's great.
We can talk later.
Yeah, there you go.
That's
you're in the right.
You know,
room.
It's events just like this. It's just connections, and we're very happy. Next up, we have John Becker with us, and John, very happy morning to you. How are things?
Very good. Thank you for having me.
It's really nice to have you. Now, in full disclosure, John's name is actually J-O-A-O, and because I'm an idiot, we spent a good 5 minutes trying to have me learn how to pronounce it, and I'm going to blame it half on my hearing. Maybe 90% of my hearing, but I keep screwing it up. So then eventually he just looked at me and said, I go by John. I was like, oh, well, that I can say. I can say that. So your name is pronounced correctly.
João. Yeah, kind of. Yeah. It's getting better. It's getting better.
Yeah. Well,
you'll have it by the end of the show. You'll have it by 10:45.
João.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's on its way. Well, they've been saying that about the show for 20 years. It's on its way. Well, tell us, John, about what you're up to.
So I'm Brazilian.
Yep.
And I'm going to college here in the U.S. I started out as an econ student, and I added finance later as a double major. And as for future plans, still kind of uncertain. I'm thinking maybe grad school in econometrics. I'm really liking that class, but not sure.
Now, how did you find out about Siena from Brazil?
So I used to go to a Franciscan high school.
Yep.
And
say no more. No, go ahead.
Yeah. They kind of have a partnership or something with Siena,
yeah.
And Brother Brian, which is the head of the international department. He went to my school.
Yep.
Talked about Siena for a bit, and I just decided to apply. It's like, why not? And I got accepted, so now I'm here.
You have amazing arm art.
Oh, thank you.
Did that come from here in the States, or is that Brazilian arm art?
Brazil.
Oh, good. I think they're better than we are.
Yeah, I did over last summer.
Oh, it's really nice. Does it signify something?
Not really. I just did what I thought was cool, and I did all freehand, so I had something unique, and I thought that was awesome.
It's beautiful. It's really beautiful art. I only wish it had a pronouncer for your name on it. Thank you very much for being here. And last but certainly not least, we welcome Arthur Pasquale to the program. Hello, Arthur. How are you?
Hi, I'm good. Thank you for having me.
Really nice to have you. So tell us your story.
So I'm also from Brazil, but I'm from São Paulo.
Okay. Did you two know each other prior?
No.
We did not. All right. I'm from São Paulo. John's from Curitiba.
By the way, and yes, I know, listeners, that Brazil is a big place. I'm just asking if there was a connection. Go ahead. Yes.
Very big, yes. São Paulo is a very big city. I came to Siena because, honestly, I thought New York State was New York City. You know Manhattan. I watched Friends. I was like, oh, that's great.
Well, weren't you surprised?
A lot of fun. Yeah, I was a little surprised, but I'm not. I don't regret it. I love Siena. I love Albany region. It's great. Yeah.
So you think you're going to, like, Central Park and you end up in Loudonville.
That's correct.
Ah, great. That's correct. Good for you.
Yeah. Take the worst.
You know, they got to start giving kids maps.
Yeah.
Well, good for you.
But the snakes up here are a lot less dangerous than the ones down in Sao Paulo and the rest of the
country. But you've been down to the city, I assume. You've had...
We have.
Okay, good. Now, so what do you want to do? What's the plan?
So I'm a senior. I'm a double major in finance and economics. Next year, I'm going to be taking the CFA exam to be a certified financial analyst. So I expect to work in the area, financial analysis.
Back to Brazil?
Probably. You can actually get to New York City with a CFA,
yes.
I would think.
Yes. So it's a good certificate. I think I would want to go to New York City.
Well, kudos to all of you and your studies and in your endeavors. I thank you so much for taking time out of your day to be with us, and special thanks to Dr. Pacitti for making this happen. He is pretty wonderful in bringing you all to us, and we thank you all for being here. So let us get...
Is he giving extra credit? If not, I would demand it.
You need extra credit for it. Isn't this lovely enough?
Yeah. They all have A's anyway. Like, it's just adding.
That's right. Their life is
fine. Unnecessary.
It's good morning. And a reminder, if you would like to be a part of the program, all you have to do is write to us, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. So Angela, Molly, John, and Arthur, the rules are here. You have your microphones. If at any time you want to jump in the conversation, we welcome you to do that. Just raise your hand. I'll call on you, and we'll be ready to go. There'll be other parts where I just ask your questions outright. And if there's anything you don't want to answer, just kind of give me and I'll move on. All right. We want you to be happy and comfortable and enjoy your stay here at WAMC and New York City North, Loudonville. Okay. Let us go to and reminder, by the way, panel, if I haven't said this, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. If you would like to get in and ask a question or make a comment about anything that we talk about this morning, we would love to have you. All right. So yesterday, we spent a good part of the week this past week talking about the nomination of Matt Gaetz as Attorney General, and then there was a series of reports and investigations and a report that was part of the Congressional Ethics Committee looking at some very serious allegations in regards to Congressman Gaetz and sex with a minor, sex trafficking, these drug-fueled parties. And so on Wednesday, Matt Gaetz went to Capitol Hill and made his way through with J.D. Vance, who will be the Vice President of the United States. And they went through a meeting with Senate leadership, trying to drum up support for Matt Gaetz. Apparently, there's various reporting on this, but I'm going to go with this story because it seems to be the most accurate, which is that there was they found another instance, another case, another woman, and some much more damaging information that they were getting ready, I believe CNN in this case, were getting ready to release. It was a short time after that President-elect Trump called up Matt Gaetz and said, I don't think you have the votes, which is a way of saying this is over. And so Matt Gaetz said that to not to bog down the process any further, he would step aside and would withdraw from to be in the running to be the Attorney General of the United States. Then, just moments later, a short time later, we got an announcement that a new AG nominee had been named. So I'm going to do this in order, but so let's talk about Matt Gaetz first, and then we'll talk about Pam Bondi, who is now the nominee for the role of Attorney General. Teresa, do you have anything you'd like to share on this?
You imagine that I might.
Yes. It may have been the text I got that said, "We live in dangerous times."
That's right. So, I mean, I think that some of this was inevitable. I mean, Matt Gaetz. It's always good to have friends. And clearly he didn't have enough of them in this case. Because I think that it's, you know, with the election of Donald Trump, well, let's say with the support, the Republicans in the Senate supported Donald Trump. And they supported him through the January 6th attack on the Capitol and all sorts of convictions, including for sexual assault and all the accusations and such. So clearly that in and of itself, Matt Gaetz' behavior in and of itself, I think, was not a disqualifier from the Trump perspective, right? But let's step back, bigger picture. The norm since post-Watergate, and maybe before, but certainly post-Watergate, has been that the Attorney General must be both independent and then competent, qualified. So clearly Matt Gaetz is not independent of Trump, and clearly his resume didn't suggest in any way, even separate from all of the accusations against him, he was in no way qualified. He is a man of few friends in the Capitol, but he had the friend that counted that was Trump. But I think in the end, the senators felt that he simply was a bomb thrower, not qualified, that they could do better. And it was just a bridge too far for them. But what he did do, he was very helpful to Trump was very helpful to him in that he was able to get this appointment, resign from this Congress, and therefore it stopped the ethics report from being published just in the nick of time. And so Trump did that for him. And in return, what he did is much of the oxygen, much of the focus has been on him. And it hasn't been in places where I think it also really needs to be. For me, number one is Tulsi Gabbard as a nominee for director of National Intelligence. I think that that needs much more scrutiny. Certainly the Secretary of Defense nominee, and I think he's the light's going to shine on him pretty quickly, given his the swirl around him. But I also think that we are not looking at things that are going on, like the potential for what's going on at the Office of Management and Budget, which really controls not just fiscal affairs, but regulatory affairs. And it looks like the key architect of Project 2025 is going to be named the head of the OMB. And that puts him, Russell Vogt, in a pretty powerful position. So Donald Trump, you know, I see nothing. I've never heard of Project 2025. I don't even know who they are. So far, four of his nominees are key to Project 2025. So I think that...
Office of Management and Budget.
So I think the Gaetz situation, it was just a matter of time before they got to where they were going. And I know we'll get to her in a minute. But I think if you look at Pam Bondi's, who's a new nominee, her connections, clearly she was the preferred person for a number of people. I think that she was inevitably going to be it anyway. But I think sort of Matt Gaetz is, this was always going to happen, but he served his purpose.
Aaron?
Yeah, I think the Gaetz nomination, which surprised, that was the first, right? That was the first cabinet nomination.
Well, I
don't think it was the first, but it was the first that made you clasp your heart.
Okay. I think that, you know, there's something strategic in doing that because I think, you know, it solved three purposes. And, you know, the first thing is that, like, remember, Trump's a narcissist. He wants the spotlight. So this was something that got people talking about Trump and what he's planning on doing. So it solved that objective. And, you know, it made a rating splash. This is a, you know, somebody who spent 16 years on The Apprentice. So this is, you know, just a reality TV show playing out in 21st century American politics. So it got Trump and the media, I'm sorry, it got the media focused on Trump because the nomination was so outlandish. The second thing is that given how outlandish it was, I think it really tired a lot of people out. Oh, how can it be Gaetz? This guy's got no experience and then blah, 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 blah. And it's almost just like, at some point, you just get worn down, and that's part of Trump's broader strategy is just lobbing these bombs into, you know, the media and the political landscape. And the reason he does that, I think, is the third reason, and that is so that people, particularly Senate Republicans who are going to be in charge of the confirmation, have a much easier time confirming someone else. They're like, well, at least it's not somebody who's been accused of having sex with underage women and sex trafficking.
Right. That's the president.
Right. That's the president.
That's the president.
So
but he got reelected.
But he shifted the goalposts so far to the, I mean, it's not even to the right. It's an outer space at this point. And anybody he nominates after that is going to appear to be a sane, qualified candidate, even if they aren't, or even if they hold very extreme positions. So I think, I don't know whether Trump actually believed Gaetz would get confirmed. I doubt he did because he's not that oblivious. And I think he used that to a very strategic effect to get to help with some of his other nominations by shifting the discussion in a direction where anyone else seems like a sane, qualified candidate.
Wouldn't you think it was the equivalent of they're eating the cats, eating the dogs? You know, it's just a tossed out there as a distraction.
I guess I don't quite understand, and we can talk about this. I want to get to Jim, but we can talk about this after we come back from break. In fact, I have a specific question for Jim about this, but which is I don't know if it was planned, and many people are saying that it was planned and it was never expected to go further. I don't quite know what Gaetz got out of it in the sense. Go ahead.
Yeah, he got the report stopped.
He said in his statement yesterday that he looks forward to serving in a new post. Well, that's not going to go away. Whatever he does, that's not going to go away. Then there's also he was still elected to the next Congress. There is a possibility that he could do that. Or he said that he could run for elected office within the state of Florida. That's still not going to go away. And we certainly know in the last 10 days a hell of a lot more about what happened than we did before. It just seems that yes, you are. No, go ahead. I'm kidding. Go ahead.
I mean, a lot of this information has been out there for a while. Right? I mean, you didn't have the obvious. Right. It appears that the lawyer leaked the chart, whoever leaked the chart. But I mean, the lawyer for the two women, you know, if you listen to conservative radio, it's all about, oh, the Democrats leaked stuff from the Department of Justice inappropriately. Well,
that's my question for Jim, but we'll get to that in a second. But
it seems like it's the lawyer who put it out there. But I mean, they were waving the charts around, the Venmo charts and stuff. But the core of it, him having, you know, sex with underage person or persons, him trafficking people, I mean, his partner is in jail for all of this.
But he was also not charged the first time around, and there was just the
he was not cleared, but he was not charged.
He was not charged, and there was just the ethics report that was being done in the House, which is different than being charged. Jim, if you would like to weigh on this, and then we'll take a break, and then I'll ask you some specific questions.
I can't wait. You know, a colleague of mine who runs a very well-respected blog, he was he's down in the D.C. area. He was actually did his Ph.D. on vice presidents, so he became like one of the world's experts on vice presidents and White House who does what and things like that. So, you know, if I have any question about the Congress, I go ask Teresa because she's been there. He is the guy who knows that. He raided... You know, his blog has been keeping a rating of competent, incompetent, traditional Republican, and Trumpist. And the first one crossed out is Gates, who was in the incompetent Trumpist category. And I couldn't say more than that. I mean, I think he's what you've all said, but, you know, one of my many predictions on this show that has not panned out was years ago when I said Gates is gone.
Yeah.
And the fact that this Congress protected him for so long, still trying to do it an hour before he quit. Say, you know, they had their committee meeting, which was rumored to be, quote, contentious, unquote.
Right.
Ended up with a party line vote to not release the ethics report.
Well,
bipartisan result. That's what it was.
I was just going to say to Jim, just by the way, we don't keep track of what you say. So if you wanted
to
rewrite history, that's been people have done that on this show for a really long time. You can say as I said, and most people will believe you.
I try to be good.
I don't think Gates is incompetent. I think, you know, in this modern world of political theater, Gates has a very important role to play, and that is the wild card whose job is just to mix it up. Like they come on stage, they make a mess, and then they leave. He did that, obviously. I mean, most notably with trying to oust McCarthy,
and on the phone with Trump the whole time.
Yeah,
on the phone with Trump the whole time.
So it's
or in the plane.
Mm-hmm.
So his job is to mix things up on Trump's behalf. It's not that he's incompetent as the attorney general.
Right.
Not a competent attorney general or to run. Yeah. No qualifications whatsoever.
Yeah. I mean, I heard that one and it was immediately clear that there's a term being thrown around, which I'm not sure whether it would cause Joe to hit the button or not. But
let's not give it a
what shot. Kind of ocracy we're going to be in the future.
Right.
And, you know, Gates was the first indication that Trump was going to be purposely putting people in positions.
Well, he's doing what he said he was going to do.
Yeah,
with all of the other nominees.
There's plenty of bad ones, yeah.
They're mostly doing what he said he was going to do.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's his revenge tour team.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue, and we welcome your letters. panel@wamc.org. We'll be back right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning, and a great group that we have before us: Teresa Bourgeois, Jim Henler, Aaron Pacitti, and his four students, John Becker, Angela Everett, Molly McBain, and Arthur Pasquale. Okay, let us continue in. We'll go to letters in a second on the Matt Gaetz issue. So here's my question for you, Dr. Henler, and it is, it's one of those things like, are we not looking at what is happening over here? So we're covering the story, and then yesterday we talked about what was going on and where at yesterday's show it was mostly about going to Capitol Hill and bringing him around and talking about Trump calling up senators and trying to gain support and all of that. Now, in the middle of this, this was, I believe, initially reported on on Monday, which was an unidentified person appears to have accessed documents shared among lawyers in a lawsuit that concerns allegations against former Congressman Matt Gaetz, according to a person who received an email notifying them of the breach. I don't know what that means. I don't know exactly how that works. I've never received something about a hacking. However, the file contains unredacted sworn testimony from a woman who said Gaetz paid her for sex when she was 17, along with other depositions from witnesses involved in the case, said a person who was notified of the hack, which was first reported by the New York Times. Gaetz has denied having sex with anyone underage or paying for sex. A person named Altam Beasley, A-L-T-A-M, Altam Beasley, downloaded the exhibits according to a confirmation email received from a shared file database. I've not been able to identify the person who downloaded the files, but I have contacted the email address provided, asking the person to identify him or herself, instructing that their access is not authorized, and telling them that they should destroy the materials they downloaded, wrote the lawyer who discovered the breach. Okay, so then 2 days later, everything falls apart, and we have all of this information, and there's all of these stories that are suddenly coming. So is it unrealistic to think that that's where a lot of this information came from?
No, it's not unrealistic at all. The real question becomes, you know, the difference between a hack, a breach, and a leak, right, used to be pretty clear. Now it's a lot less so. So a leak is traditionally somebody who's has some information and says, I just got to tell somebody about this and just want to make sure it doesn't get
Oops,
back to me.
Oops, I left this briefcase with all of my notes on the park bench.
Well, or you know, I phoned up Joe Donahue and I told him all this stuff and just asked him, please don't report it on tomorrow's roundtable with the following people and particularly asking the following questions and
Teresa.
Things like that.
Okay, go ahead.
I mean, here I thought we would have Kwani Chung here today. Yeah. But no. then a hack is really where someone breaks into files and things like that. And of course, we've seen that with the emails from back all the way to the Clinton campaign and, you know, computer security, we'll do a vox pop on that one again one of these days. But then there's the thing in the middle, which is sort of somebody who knows the information's there kind of guides someone who's not supposed to see it there. So it's kind of like a leak and kind of like a hack, but you don't have to break into the computer, which is an illegal activity, to do it. And so what's been very unclear in this reporting is how much of what's come out was in which category. But once there was the stuff, once the stuff starts to come out, then it becomes much easier for other people who've seen it to say, oh, yes, I saw it. You know, then you get verification. Then you get validation. So,
well, you have an entire committee that had seen the report, right?
Right. But they were, you know, sort of, quote, sworn to secrecy.
Of course.
So, and
but now
and,
it's out there.
Right. And once it's out there, and, you know, there's still most of them will not answer questions on it. It's just that now there's other people who've seen it who can answer.
But it's like questions. The diagram. I think that's what, it's the diagram that the Times printed. I mean, did that come from Altam Beasley?
We don't know.
Yeah.
But the lawyer for the two women who were called, so as I understand it, he was not the lawyer for the two women, one of whom, you know, we're both involved in at these some 10 or so quote unquote parties that
Joel Lepard.
There you go, Joel. He was quite interesting. I mean, he went on TV. He was on MSNBC. He was on CNN. He did detailed interviews. And as I understood it from listening to him, he could not talk about the Justice Department interactions. But he could legally, but very artfully, talk about the testimony, you know, what he was framing it as in the context of what his clients were asked. When they were asked about X, they answered truthfully. When they were asked about the Venmo payments that were in a chart, they testified truthfully. You know, it was the kind of way he answered the questions. And he said it was all for the purpose of that these two women absolutely did not want to have to testify publicly. They didn't think they should have to. They thought it would put them at risk. They did not want to. His task for his clients was to ensure they didn't have to testify publicly. And also, so presumably a lot of this came from, a lot of this came from what he was saying on TV. He talked about the Venmo chart in the afternoon, and that night there was an N New York Times story.
But back to your earlier point, which I think is good to go back to, which is, this is a story that the New York Times had been covering. They had made allusions to,
for a couple of years,
to a chart and so forth, in two or three years ago.
Because
so,
remember, there's one of the people is sitting in jail for this.
Correct.
And so there was
11 years, by the way.
Right. So there has been court activity on this. There has been speculation on this for a couple of years, and so none of this is new. I think what happens is if you concentrate one's attention to it, right? People in Florida, reporters in Florida have been focusing on this for a long time.
The amazing thing, real quick, the amazing thing for me, there's a lot of things that make Gates unqualified for this position, just a complete and total lack of discretion and illegal behavior.
But, and a punchable face.
But also never managed
the Botox
anything.
And the eyes. Like, yeah, no.
Okay,
off track. If you're going to engage in this activity, don't use Venmo.
Exactly.
Really? That's one of the, if there's something unqualifying him for having a position like a
drug dealers
general.
Have been telling that for
exactly.
years. Like, don't use public
Venmo. That's what $100 bills are for.
That now the other
and Bitcoin.
What are we all doing right here, Joe?
So
what are we all doing? We're talking about Matt Gaetz. We're not talking about Tulsi Gabbard. We're not talking about all of these other ish. No. Yeah. I'm not Chris. I'm saying that this works for Trump, right? It works for Trump. It works. It has worked for him over and over and over and over again.
I agree, but I think if all this other stuff hadn't come out, I don't know that it would have been the circus that it was. But we can argue about that.
You know, he's the what do you call it? The head of the circus.
Ringmaster.
He's the ringmaster of the circus, right?
Without the hat. Okay.
And, you know, of course, we should be talking about the America First Policy Institute. But, you know, who wants to talk about that? That's only what's driving where we're going. Right?
We're still worried about ratings. Okay. So let us, in our moments before we go to the top of the hour break, talk about Pam Bondi. Now, with Matt Gaetz out of the way and Matt Gaetz saying, okay, Mr. President-elect, I will withdraw my nomination. Then there was a flurry of stories as to, well, we're back to the drawing board. There's no idea. This could take weeks to figure out who is going to be the next nominee for the Attorney General. And before they could go to commercial, Pam Bondi was announced, who served on his legal team during his first impeachment. And if anything we should say about this is that here is a human who actually has served in the role as Attorney General in the state of Florida, and so this Pam Bondi is the person that President-elect Trump has chosen to be Attorney General. She is a loyalist. She has that experience, especially in Florida, and he sees a Justice Department that is very politically hostile to him and feels that she is the person to turn that around. Jim Hendler.
I was watching MSNBC last night and caught Alex Wagner, whose intro was, breaking news today, Trump takes a scandal-ridden Trump loyalist who has defended him in many ways, out of the running for AG, and instead appoints a Trump loyalist, scandal-ridden person. She said it better. But it was really, it was like, if you could find somebody who was as close as possible to Gates in terms of loyalty, willingness to do things, owing Trump a favor, for those who don't know.
Yes, but without the possibility of felonies.
Yeah. I mean, she was looking into Trump University. Suddenly the charges were dropped. Just by coincidence, Trump had just before that given a very large donation to a, I forget whether it was a foundation or whatever, that she ran.
Not for profit.
I mean, you know, it was like, in a normal democracy, that would have been such a scandal that it would have ended careers. And I mean, so would Trump having been, you know, convicted of rape. So would all these other things. I mean, it's just stunning what's going on now. And I would say I'm left speechless, but I've been talking about how I'm speechless. But the key thing is, I think Aaron did put it right, which is that I don't think Trump was putting Gates out there as a, you know, great, they'll shoot him down and I'll be able to put someone else in. I think he wanted Gates through. But Trump is amazingly good at turning on the dime. In fact, an hour before he told Gates that, you know, he didn't have the votes, he was interviewed on TV. And they said, you know, are you going to withdraw your nomination of Gates? And his answer was one word, no. Right? And, of course, he didn't. He let Gates resign. But, I mean, it's
I do also
theater
think
at its best.
I want to get the other reactions here. But I do think it's interesting, this Florida connection. Mm-hmm. And one of the things about Pam Bondi is that she is very close with Susie Wiles.
Right.
They have a lot of ties within the Florida political scene, which is sort of becoming the epicenter of much of the activity that's taking place.
Marco Rubio.
As far as the nominations go from Mar-a-Lago.
Trump has redefined politics from public service for the greater good to transactional for his own good and the good of his, inner circle. So this isn't surprising. It's another loyalist who puts, the interest of Trump above the interest of the country. You know, she's anti-same-sex marriage. She's anti-recreational marijuana. She wants to overturn the Affordable Care Act. I mean, this is a reactionary person who is, just because she held an attorney general position in the state of Florida, is very dangerous. And, you know, she's proven her loyalty to Trump. And this is like watching an episode of The Sopranos and The Apprentice combined into one. And I feel bad I keep making TV references, but Trump is an entertainer. And this is clearly where he's taking his marching orders from, in that it's like, well, who's most loyal to Tony Soprano? They're the one that gets promoted to, you know, a captain or whatever. It's the same thing here. This is entirely transactional. And the fact that he announced her so quickly after Gates said he was withdrawing is remarkable, and also a sign that he clearly had somebody else in mind.
Had a plan. Yeah.
Right. I mean, I presume that she was at the top of the list of the transition team's picks, right? And then he was on the airplane, had this notion, Gates, okay, we're going with Gates. But because she is very close to Susie Wiles, the new chief of staff, they worked in the same law firm. But I think, you know, Trump told us what he was going to do. This is Exhibit A of what he was going to do. And they basically now, he has shifted his legal team off of the campaign payroll onto the government payroll at the Department of Justice, because it's not just her. It's also Todd Blanche, his lawyer, Emil Bovee, John Sawyer. All of those people are being moved into top Justice Department positions. This is, you know, the A-team for his revenge tour. But I do think it's very, very important to look at her history and the kinds of things that she represented him on, both in the impeachment hearing. She was one of his lawyers, but also on the what she did on January 6th and what she did in the 2020 election in terms of voter fraud and those issues. And I really urge people, there's been a lot of focus on Project 2025. I think people have to also focus on the America First Policy Institute, and because a lot of these people are coming out of the America First Policy Institute, and she was the chair of its Center for Litigation and the co-chair of its Center for Law and Justice. And looking at the plans that are outlined there, I think will give people an understanding of where these folks on a policy side want to take the country.
We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation. We'll move on to other issues, and we'll include your letters as well. We'll also hear from our incredible students who are with us today. All of that and much more. First News with Ray Graff. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. 8 minutes past 10 o'clock on this Friday morning, the 22nd of November. Let me reintroduce our panel. If you are just joining us, Teresa Bourgeois is a public policy and communications expert. Jim Henler is Tetherless World Professor of Computer, Web, and Cognitive Sciences at RPI, otherwise known as Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute. And Aaron Pasitti is Siena College Professor of Economics, otherwise known as Siena College. We also welcome four of his amazing students. Angela Everett is here, Molly McBain. We welcome John Becker and Arthur Pasquale, and we will talk to them in just a few moments. Thank you very much for being with us. Again, if you have anything you'd like to add to the equation, please write to us, panel at wamc.org, panel at wamc.org. We'll get to some more letters of things that are on people's minds as we go through the show later on. I do want to move on to a topic I have. Actually, this is something that was in the Wall Street Journal, referred to as The Apprentice, the Treasury edition. And this is a very interesting article and passed on to me by Aaron Pasitti. And one thing that I wanted to talk about today, Trump's growth and trade agendas are at odds. His economic team will point to the winner. So in other words, you win either way. There is no loser in this, because tax cuts, deregulation, and budget deficits would push up the dollar and worsen the trade deficit, while steep tariffs would undermine growth. All of this to say that there are many facets to this story. So, Aaron, please let us know what we should be aware of here.
The thing that got me thinking about this was that with the flurry of cabinet nominations, there's been one of the largest nominations, and that Secretary of the Treasury, that where he's been completely silent on it. And I was thinking to myself last week, who would want that job, working for somebody who's got a mishmash of policy ideas, many of which are at odds with one another? If you do this, then it makes this other platform less powerful. And if you do that, then it makes the other one less powerful. So who he chooses is going to have their hands full, because he's got essentially four economic policy concepts of a policy. And, you know, there's the tax cuts. Tax cuts will blow up the deficit, and that'll increase inflation and interest rates. He's got his mass deportation and immigration restrictions, which will also increase inflation but slow growth because we're reducing the labor supply. His tariff policy, that'll increase inflation and also slow growth. And then his desire to have the Fed fall under more – his goal to have the Federal Reserve become more politicized, and that will slow growth and raise interest rates. So the job of the secretary, or the Treasury Secretary, is to essentially implement the country's fiscal policy, But also, they have a bigger role in making sure bond markets and stock markets function the way they're supposed to. So if you pass the tax cuts and blow up the deficit and that leads to higher inflation, implementing tariffs becomes a lot more difficult because you're going to have a much stronger dollar, which is going to make nullify the effects of the tariffs. And I don't want to get into too much detail in theory here, but it's like a three-legged stool. And if you remove
save that for your class.
Yeah, if you remove any of the legs, the stool falls over, right? So you can't have all of these things. So some of the people that whose names have been floated, Summer Wall Street people, but the interesting name was Kevin Warsh, who was a former governor of the Federal Reserve System, who is probably the sanest of the bunch. He's definitely very conservative. He's a very traditional neoliberal supply-sider that believes in trickle-down economics. I don't think he believes in trickle-down economics. He believes in implementing policies that redistribute wealth from middle and upper middle-class families to the very wealthy. And the goal of the government is not to have broad-based growth. It's to use the government as a way to make the wealthy wealthier. So my bet is that Kevin Warsh gets the appointment because he has experience with the Federal Reserve, which will be a calming force to markets. But he is also very much a free trader. So what you'll see are things like the immigration restrictions and the tariffs kind of fizzle away in favor of just massive tax cuts, which is, I think, why most people which I think is what most Republicans and campaign donors want to see. So that's my prediction. And I feel bad for him because, again, Trump's been talking about all tariffs, the most beautiful word in the English language. And if, you know, his Secretary of Treasury says, we can't do that or else you're going to unsettle markets and then we have a much more fragile system, God knows what's going to happen after that.
So is it... What are we looking at as far as a time frame here of when we'll start to get a sense of how all this is going?
Well, there's urgency because of the tax cuts.
Right.
It's set to expire.
I think no matter – I don't know the answer to that. I know he wants to – you know, the mass deportations on day one, you know, the 60% tariffs on Chinese goods and the 20% across the board tariffs –
I don't mean to be dismissive, but I mean, you know, there were a lot of things on day one. Right?
Sure.
So we don't know what actually.
So I think, you know.
There's some deadlines.
Well, there are some deadlines. But the tradition in a magic show or in a performance or in a reality TV show is you sort of have something over here and you get people to look over there while you do something back here.
Right.
And we're on radio so no one can see what I'm doing. But, you know, it's you distract them, you get them to look in the wrong place and
right.
then can, you know, disappear the thing you're disappearing, et cetera, et cetera. And Trump's been a master at that. And, you know, that's his background has been that kind of performative and transactional world. And I think what I would believe is going to happen economically is for the first year or two, he's riding the boom that was created by Biden. So everything's going to be looking good for a while, which leaves him not to have to worry about if inflation's going down, he'll say, well, you know, I'm going to hold my tariffs back for now and things like that. So and he has no belief in being consistent.
Right.
So my actual prediction is he's going to ride that out for a couple of years. The tax thing will be his most important one,
yeah.
And that's because Elon Musk and some of the other people who gave him a whole lot of money want to see that happen. And the one that I think is going to be the really interesting thing is to see what happens with cryptocurrencies.
I think you can bet on tax cuts, making the Trump tax cuts. That the 2017 Tax Cuts and Jobs Act was the only legislative achievement of the first Trump administration.
Right.
There were these little tariffs. They had no effect. The trade deficit actually increased under Trump. Manufacturing employment fell. It's not like the tariffs did anything he promised, but he made a big splash out of it. What you can expect to happen, to Joe's point, in terms of a timeline, I would bet within the first 6 months, maybe the first year, if you want to be more conservative, that his tax cuts become permanent.
Yeah.
And that's a $5 trillion cost to the government over a decade. So there's an opportunity cost to that. What else could we buy as a country instead of giving $5 trillion away to millionaires and billionaires? Well, there's a lot of things. Healthcare, childcare, student loan forgiveness, you name it. But that is that I guarantee will happen because that's, yep. He knows who's buttering his bread, and the tax cuts are a way to pay back for that.
Yeah.
Yes.
I think probably one of the most concerning things about Trump is he makes all of these promises when he campaigns, you know, the 60% tariffs, and a lot of people dismiss them and say, you know, oh, he's not really going to do that. He's just trying to get people fired up. And I think the concerning thing is there's no real way to understand what he's actually going to do versus what was an empty promise. So you don't know how afraid you really need to be for his policy implementations.
But the real world impacts, I think you're absolutely right. But I noticed a little blurb in Bloomberg the other day where Redfin Corporation had projected mortgage rates would average around 6.1%. I'm reading from this blurb. But then 3 days after the election, they revised that estimate upward to 6.8% and said the difference is Trump. Their chief economist at Redfin said, quote, "The market seems to be pricing in all that he'll move forward with at least some of the tariffs. It's another hit for the housing market that's been dealing with a rise in borrowing costs that's pushed at least one measure of mortgage rates above 7%. And so while he campaigned on, you know, the Biden-Harris administration is driving up mortgage rates, in fact, mortgage rates had been coming down, but this threat of tariffs, just the threat of tariffs,
absolutely
has bounced mortgage rates back up. This is just one little indicator that has a real live impact today, this week, on people, particularly young people, trying to buy homes.
So, Teresa, I would just add one thing real quick. The group you're quoting is a nonpartisan group. It's not a group that, if some Democratic group said that, you'd have lots of people who could say, okay, that's just a political thing. This Bloomberg team is economic analysts, yeah, who really have no tie to a political party, and, you know, or to a political
J.P. statement. Morgan, Goldman Sachs, all of their macro forecasting teams are predicting very similar things,
yeah,
that you're going to see percentage points increases in interest rates. So the cost of borrowing, whether it's for a home, whether it's for a new car, whether it's the interest rate on your credit card, those are going to go up no matter what policy he puts in place. So it's the cruel irony here is that these policies are going to hurt the people that voted him into the hardest core of the MAGA base are going to be the ones who are most affected by these policies.
Go ahead.
It does seem that culturally there's been this big shift where we no longer listen to the people that we used to, like PhD economists, Nobel winning economists. Their opinion is largely irrelevant to a big majority in the United States. And I am interested to see how, if any of these economic policies do play out, how his base will react to the largely inflationary consequences of them, and how he can spin it to blame it on somebody else like he normally does.
How do you think his base will react?
It seems that regardless of what he does, there's always somebody else to blame. And I would hope that it would maybe teach a lesson or urge people to learn more about just general economic principles like tariffs, inflation. Unfortunately, though, I don't know if I have much hope that people will take this as a lesson and try to look into things more.
Molly making the point that I just want to quickly ask, I want to hear from others too, but quickly ask you, Aaron, do you see that too, that those of people in your profession who have this knowledge are cast aside?
Yeah.
And it wasn't always the case.
No, I mean, I think you alluded to this with part of one of the events tonight, how the nature of truth in a post-truth world.
Right.
You know, Trump is essentially throwing your intro to, you know, macro textbooks out the window and saying, well, the laws of economics don't apply to me. Right. It's like saying, well, okay, well, the law of gravity doesn't apply to me either. There are some pretty, you know, say what you want, whether you agree with the policies or not. If you do this, then that's going to happen. If you blow up the deficit when the economy is growing rapidly, inflation and interest rates go up.
Arthur?
Yeah, it's sad because I think we're getting most of our information from people that are not really, that don't have a lot to say about it. Angela was talking about fake promises that Trump might make. And I understand that that might work when he's trying to get elected, when he says, I'm going to do a 60% tax cut on China and 20% tax cut on other countries. But after you're elected, it doesn't work anymore. You got to put it into practice. So people are gonna see what's gonna happen after his tariff policies. And it doesn't, if he just says, I'm gonna make tariffs on imported products and I'm gonna pass them down to consumers. Consumers are not gonna pay enough tax, as many taxes anymore. It doesn't work like that. The math doesn't add up. So we just,
yeah, he doesn't believe in math either.
He doesn't.
Yeah. He doesn't believe in economics. He does have a Sharpie. Not to take this too far off topic, but there was a report yesterday about how Florida's trying to ban the teaching of a lot of social sciences.
Right.
Well, economics is a social science. And there's, and again, we're back to the magic of Florida with Bondi and Gates and DeSantis, and now they want to get rid of social science education. And the reason why is so politicians can get away with saying this garbage. You don't want people calling you out and saying, well, that's actually not true.
But one of the things, and I know you want to say, one of the things that I've been concerned about, I try to listen to as much conservative radio and Fox as I can, just because I want to understand what their core message is. And one of the things I've heard over and over in the last week is that these economic numbers weren't true, that the Treasury baked the numbers, that the Biden administration had faked the numbers. And so they're setting Trump up for failure because they have these fake data, just like he said in advance of the election. You know, the elections are rigged, but it's the economic equivalent. And that is so dangerous to get people to not trust the data.
John?
Yeah. What scares me about Trump's promises is that as inflation and interest rates rise, unemployment can become a problem, as the Fed is just now addressing it. It's still above 4%, and they're lowering rates to combat unemployment. But if Trump's policies come into action, it'll just like mess the entire thing. The Fed won't be able like to handle both problems at once. And it can have a huge impact in American lives.
So what if you add climate change to the professor's list? Because the Trump team, they're primarily climate deniers, right? So what about the economics of being a climate denier? What economic impact is that going to have on your
family? Aaron, make it more depressing. That's for you and anyone else who wants it. Sorry.
The dealing with climate change is going to involve hundreds of billion dollars of investment, right? You're going to need massive upfront costs to get this infrastructure in place. So if the Trump policies get implemented, almost all of them are going to be inflationary. And when they become inflationary, like John pointed out, the Fed has to raise interest rates to combat inflation. And by doing that, that pushes interest rates economy wide up, which makes investing in renewable energies that much more unaffordable. So it actually compounds the climate crisis issue. It makes those investments less, would lower the rate of return.
But he's promised to stop the funding that was in the Inflation Reduction Act, in particularly the clean energy portions. And a lot of that funding is funding that fueled manufacturing returning to the U.S. And so if they shut off that pipeline of funding, if they shut off that pipeline of funding for chips, as they promised, if they've shut off that pipeline for funding for the infrastructure,
Well, how else are you going to give Elon Musk a tax cut?
Well, I
yeah, Teresa.
No. I know that. Well, the Elon Musk thing, I think this Doge group where they said the other day, Musk and Ramaswamy, their target is to cut $2 trillion from the budget. Well, $1.63 trillion is discretionary. Everything else is mandatory, right? And of that discretionary, a large portion of that is defense, right? And so all of the programs that they talk about attacking are only a very small portion, not nearly $2 trillion. So how does that math work, right? That's ending all of Jim Hendler's funded programs, right? That's ending all of the... You can't do that without Medicare, Medicaid cuts. And, of course, you have Pam Bondi and others who are anti the health care programs. But really, climate change is their future. So if you don't believe in climate change and you say we're not going to invest in that and you get out of COP and you get out of the COP program, what are the economic impacts of that?
Well, there definitely are economic impacts, but I think the problem with climate change is it's going to be really hard to get the proper policy passed, because lots of times when you talk to people about climate change, they simply just don't believe in the data. And you can't argue with someone when their only argument against you is just that the data is false. So you can show them the economic implications. You can show them that this is what's going to happen. But if that person's willing to write off very clear data, they're going to write off your economic implementation as well.
But do they need data when they can go to North Carolina or see the pictures from North Carolina or the fires outside of New York?
But it's easy to write those as one. Well, that was just an anomaly. It was a storm of the century, right? It's not part of the story.
A storm of the century until we have one by the end of
the year. Right, and then there'll be another storm of the century in 2026.
Or the bomb cyclone in Seattle area the last few days and all the destruction that did.
Great Barrington
fire.
And I think this is just living in a post-truth world. If somebody says something that you don't agree with, no matter how clear the evidence is, you just say, well, the numbers are baked and that's false.
Arthur, we have a minute. Go ahead.
Yeah, so we're still living in an era where it's not yet profitable to invest a lot of your company's activities in sustainable practices. So I think that's why it's so important for governments to be on top of companies, you know, putting more taxes, making them really be more sustainable.
Actually, to work for the betterment of human
society, yeah.
And in fact, part of the problem is that's exactly the opposite of what's happening. The current economic reality is it's actually cheaper to move to sustainable energy unless the government is giving tax breaks and funding to the oil companies.
All right, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we will continue our conversation, and we'll wrap up for this edition of the Roundtable. I haven't said this to the other groups, but you may be my favorite. I know you can't have favorites, but they're really good.
They are really good.
We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue, and we welcome your letters, panel at wamc.org, panel at wamc.org. First, we go to news from the BBC. Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Teresa Bourgeois, Jim Hendler, and Aaron Pasitti. Aaron has also brought with him students who are all economics majors from Siena College's Federal Reserve Challenge course. We just have a few moments before we wrap up, and I'm just curious from all of the students, but I'd like to especially go to Arthur and John, because you're both from Brazil, and I'm curious just a general of what the thoughts of the United States and its economy as you were growing up, and how those thoughts have changed as you've come here and started to study.
So I think that pretty much anywhere in the world, the United States is highly influential. Not just economically, but with Hollywood, music.
Right.
So pretty much everyone grows up, even if they don't speak English, they know the United States, they want to go in there. When I got here, I don't think I felt like it changed from like the perspective I had before. I think that when you get here, you start to realize, especially in the economics courses, how important the United States is to the world economy and how it affects everything. So...
Because we think of that thing like the American dream. We're going to go to America and the American dream. Do you feel that way, or is that just BS?
Yeah, I think I've met a lot of people who feel that way. They didn't speak any English. They were struggling to find a job in Brazil. And when you asked them what their dream was, they said they wanted to come to the U.S. and live here. So I do think that the United States is very influential.
Arthur?
Yeah, it's different for sure than what we see on the TV, what we hear from the news, this big, the paradise that the United States promotes itself for other countries outside.
More pharmaceutical commercials in real life. Yeah.
I think some stuff still gets us pretty disappointed, like the Pam Bondi indication. You're like, it's expected from Trump. She follows the same things, the same policies that Trump follows, but it's not really progressive as other countries such as Brazil has been in some areas moving forward, and you see America, this big influential country, sometimes moving backwards in terms of abortion, in terms of legalization or the Affordable Care Act, all this type of stuff. So it's conflicting.
Also, and is it because you're all very young, you're all 20, 21?
Yeah.
So that this has been, you know, we've been in a Trump era for 9 of those years. And I'm curious as to, even before that, if you come out and say that it's, you still look at it as, while we in this country look, on this show, we are constantly accused of pearl clutching and saying, oh, my God, and the world's gone to hell. And that's not just Teresa. And but
we live in dangerous times.
That's right. We live in dangerous times. But you don't feel that way as much, I assume, when you're before you came here.
No, not at all.
Yeah.
I think there's a good United States does a good job on promoting life here. And at the same time, it doesn't want certain types of people to come. So that's interesting. We were talking about immigration and... Because we're not immigrants. We're white Brazilians that come here for school. We have non-immigration status. But we do know people that are trying to get here. And it makes it harder for them. So yeah, it's not a dream that was promoted before we came, for sure.
That's a fascinating perspective. Molly.
Yeah. When you talk about the American dream, I think it's interesting because it's something that, you know, as growing up as an American, you always hear about it and you learn about it. I think as I've become more educated, I still have hopes, but that dream has certainly faded away a little bit. When you look into what our, not even just Trump, but most of our politicians are doing, it seems that big money interests are much more relevant to them than the people that they're supposed to be representing. Mm. And even like from a female perspective, like I was surprised that Gates withdrew, just because I looked at it from the perspective of President Trump has had a large history of sexual misconduct, and he's president. And I honestly didn't think that would be where the line was drawn for most of the senators, and especially Republican senators. So when you're talking about an American dream, I don't think it's impossible, but I feel like it is fading away, especially for young people.
That's, well, I certainly understand that. Yeah. Angela.
Yeah, so we're all young enough that this presidential election was the first one time that I was able to vote in a presidential election. And it was, you know, it was very exciting. Molly and I were talking about how we felt very hopeful that day for the country. But I'm young enough. I can't remember a time where politics was not at the current state that it was. You know, the first time Trump ran, I was pretty young. And I remember everyone saying that this is insane, but then I grew up with it. So it's kind of shocking how I'm almost not shocked at some of the things that are coming out. It's now the norm for people to get away with things because they have money. And it might have always been that way, but it's becoming incredibly apparent now. And, you know, that whole idea of the future is female, it's hard to really believe that in the current state that we live in. So...
Were your hopes dashed? I mean, is of being this is for both of you, but being young women that you think that had the election results been different, that it you would have felt different about being women and the future and what you were able to achieve?
I mean, absolutely. In finance and economics, those are both very male-dominated fields. That's where I spend all of my time in college, is, you know, the token female in my finance classes. So this idea that a woman would have been able to be president was this very exciting idea. And the fact that she lost to a convicted felon who mistreated women so horribly, it really did just sting a little bit harder.
Molly?
Yeah, I definitely agree with everything Angie said. When the news broke, it was definitely hit me harder, just because I think the magnitude that Harris lost by was pretty disappointing.
Yeah,
she was highly qualified. I don't like to romanticize any politician, but when you compare her to Trump, it seemed like the results should have not turned out the way that they did. And so I think a lot of women were disappointed and kind of fearful of the fact that maybe one of the reasons the margin was so large between her and Trump was due to the fact that she is a woman, and she is a woman of color.
Yeah.
And yet you keep going.
You have to, right? Yeah. I think if you stop caring and you stop trying, then, I mean, you lose everything, right? So all you can do is just, you know, keep trying to stay informed, stay educated, do what you can.
Molly McBain, Angela Everett, John Becker, and Arthur Pasquale, I thank you all for being with us. It's been a great pleasure to have you on the program and sharing your insights and thoughts. It's you don't know what a gift it is to us to have you all here. So thank you very, very much. And hopefully you had fun, too. My thanks also, of course, to Dr. Aaron Pasitti, the man who makes all this possible. And by that, I mean bringing you all here, although he makes everything possible. Siena College Professor of Economics, thank you, Aaron, as always.
Of course, my pleasure.
It's wonderful to have you. We also want to thank Jim Henler, Tetherless World Professor of Computer, Web, and Cognitive Science Sciences at RPI, who generally hides his students.
I keep offering to bring them, and Sarah keeps saying, no, we already have too much.
Oh, we welcome. Well,
crap from you.
Bring them along. And, of course, Teresa Bourgeois. Thank you very much, Teresa.
Thank you. And I'd like a little second of hope, which is the Senate elected four amazing women, more Democratic women. There were women elected all over the country. So, indeed, it was so disappointing. But I think the innovation is going to happen at the state and local level, and we did see some really amazing women. So there's still, as discouraging as it is, there's a little ray of sunshine out there somewhere.
And in fact, we have now the first trans person, although
yeah,
there's now a big fight going on about whether she'll be allowed to use the bathrooms.
Yes. We're out of time, but thank you all. Chuck Todd is next.